Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and having just graduated from my one-year BA program, I decided to take a break from the traditional interview format for this podcast in order to share with listeners, this week and next, what I've learned from a year immersed in MOOCs and other forms of free learning. For those just tuning into this project for the first time, Degree of Freedom was my attempt to discover whether it was possible to learn the equivalent of what you would get from a four-year liberal arts BA program in just 12 months using the new no-cost teaching tools that have come online over the last couple of years. The project was triggered when I completed another podcast-related educational program in 2012, one which used that year's presidential election as a case study to teach a range of practical critical thinking skills. The podcast and associated curriculum is still available at www.criticalvoter.com, including the last show where I recommended that anyone interested in taking their study of critical thinking further might want to consider taking a course in logic. And lo and behold, once that program wrapped, a free course on the subject showed up on my radar, one entitled Think Again, How to Reason and Argue, taught by Duke University professor Walter Sinnott Armstrong and his teaching partner, UNC professor Ram Netta, delivered through a company I had never heard of before called Coursera. Deciding to eat my own dog food, that's one of those phrases used frequently by business people, by the way, along with drinking the Kool-Aid, both of which are fairly horrific to those of us who know their origins. Where was I? Oh yes, dog food. So having just told people they should go out and take a course like Think Again, I decided to enroll myself and see what it was like. As backdrop, I've always been a bit of a recreational learner, which is why you're more likely to find iTunes lectures on my iPhone than music. When I started taking Sinnott Armstrong and Netta's course, I treated it like any other recorded educational program, listening to lectures in my car or at the gym, but not engaging very much beyond that. Then it came time to take my first graded quiz, which I did, earning a score of 80%. Now, having taught a course in critical thinking just a few months earlier, I was surprised with this result. But since the material in that first exam was relatively new, it covered a method of translating human language into formal arguments I hadn't seen before, my low score did not inspire me to change my learning method. And so I spent the second quarter, one where Professor Netta taught us about truth tables, treating Think Again like just another MP3. And when it came time to take the graded quiz for the second part of the class, I also scored an 80%. It was at this point that some earlier professional experience allowed those two 80% to speak to me. For in a previous life, I'd created a professionally designed certification exam to measure the somewhat complex construct of digital literacy. And putting aside most of the story of how that program was created, the cut score for the exam was, you guessed it, 80%. Now, in professional certification or licensure or educational exam creation, cut scores are set very carefully using one or more rigorous statistical procedures, leading to a pass-fail score that will separate those who have mastered the material from those who have not. And I know our cut score was set well because every time we gave the test to knowledgeable teachers just being introduced to the product, they all failed right below the cut score, which is what you'd expect from people familiar with a subject who had not studied for a particular test. That experience taught me that while I was familiarizing myself with the subject being taught in Think Again, I wasn't really learning it. And so for the second half of the course, I treated exactly like I would a live college class, taking notes, repeating lectures until I finally grasped the material, putting time between finishing a set of lectures and trying associated homework problems to ensure that the information I'd been taught had been internalized. And sure enough, treating this MOOC with the same seriousness one would treat a brick-and-mortar college class raised my grade into the 90s. This whole experience left the impression that something new and potentially revolutionary was happening with this thing called a MOOC. Were robust and comprehensive college-level classes indeed now available for free? And so I spent some time reading up on the massive open learning phenomena to see what other people were saying about it. And apparently, I was a latecomer to this whole MOOC phenom. But this was the end of 2012, when MOOC mania was still running wild. Times columnist Tom Friedman declared them the wave of the educational future. Sebastian Thrun, founder of Udacity, was boldly predicting that in 50 years, MOOCs would leave only 10 colleges standing. The media, both educational and popular, were running endless stories about a MOOC revolution as companies like Coursera and edX, both created in 2012, were building consortia of what seemed like the most prestigious colleges and universities in the country, eager to create free courses to teach the world. But as I read those heady stories, there seemed to be an important voice missing from the conversation. Yes, professors were talking about their experience creating and teaching a MOOC, and students were commenting on what they had gone through taking one or two. MOOC providers are, of course, predicting a rosy future for the new teaching medium, and journalists and educational policymakers seem quite excited about their potential to solve problems ranging from the cost of higher education to third world poverty. But missing in all this discussion was the voice of someone who had actually taken not just one MOOC or dabbled in a dozen but only finished one or two, but all the courses required to see how MOOCs would compare to a four-year degree-bearing college program. For only by taking all the courses that would parallel a full degree BA would someone be able to say how much MOOCs stacked up against the traditional learning experience, as well as gain enough exposure to not just MOOCs but all forms of free learning from different schools using different teaching methods and technologies. It was at that point that the three words that tend to send shudders through my household were uttered. Why not me? And so I began the process of supplementing the one MOOC credit I just earned for Think Again with more than 30 other courses that would be spread out over 2013. This project, eventually dubbed Degree of Freedom, was modeled on the structure of a liberal arts BA program, which involved taking 32 courses to completion, 10 of which would meet distribution requirements spread out over science, social science, and humanities courses, and 10 courses dedicated towards a major. In order to see if MOOCs could cut it in a subject other than computer science, which is what they're still most well known for, I chose to major in a non-science discipline of philosophy. Now, this choice of majors was also based on other factors. Notably, I'd already studied science, chemistry in case you're interested, when I earned my original BA at Wesleyan University many years ago, and didn't see any reason to repeat the same experience during my one-year BA. More importantly, if I was going to dedicate a year to studying a subject, it had to be something I was already interested in. And philosophy, especially ancient philosophy, was a topic that had captured my fancy, and so I dedicated my major to a portion of that subject I knew nothing about, yet, modern philosophy. Selecting courses was next up, and since I was just starting out and had a few restrictions on what to study beyond the need to meet distribution requirements for my freshman and sophomore years, which ran from January 1st to June 30th, I was spoiled for choice. So I signed up for another three courses from Coursera, the modern and the postmodern in property and liability, both from Wesleyan University, and a course on Einstein's theory of special relativity from Stanford. Two Harvard courses from edX, Justice and Ancient Greek Hero, two from Udacity, Introduction to Statistics and Starting a Business, as well as some classes from MOOC providers outside the Big Three, including an art history course from Udemy, and an education course in cheating and online classes offered by the Canvas Network. Since I was also interested in seeing how these courses compared to classes from non-MOOC sources, I included some lecture courses from the Harvard Extension School, OpenYale, and iTunes U in the mix, as well as some classes from lower-tech educational publishers like Modern Scholar and The Great Courses. As I made my way through these first 16 courses from different vendors taught with different structures and formats, I quickly discovered something they all had in common. They're all taught by able lecturers who treated students like adults eager to learn. Where these courses seemed to diverge was in how much they asked of we eager students beyond watching the lectures and taking notes. For example, Coursera's Modern the Postmodern required us to write up to 8 papers, and my Udacity statistics class couldn't go 5 minutes before asking us to perform a statistical calculation using an equation or technique we had just learned. Harvard's Ancient Greek Hero required us to engage deeply with a number of challenging texts, including Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, plays from the Greek tragedians, and dialogues of Plato. This required reading was accompanied by some very challenging assessment exercises that required students to understand subtle distinctions and arguments in order to get a perfect score, which I never did. But while some of my classes came with college-level workloads, it was also clear that not all courses were going to place high demands on students working to obtain a certificate of completion. For example, many of my humanities courses were much shorter than what you might count for a full semester. 6 to 8 weeks seemed to be becoming a standard, and within these short courses, passing often involved nothing more than answering a few relatively easy multiple-choice questions each week. It was during this period that I began to ask why we might consider an iTunes U course, such as the Ohio State Astronomy class I took on life and the universe, as being a lesser educational experience than a MOOC. After all, that Ohio State course consisted of 44 full-length recorded lectures from a real-life full-semester class. And because it was a live class, an existing Ohio State webpage included a syllabus I could follow along with, and even problem sets I was able to download and do as if I were actually enrolled in the class. Now, these problems were not automatically graded like they would be in a MOOC, and I didn't receive a certificate of completion for passing that iTunes U course, but it did bring up the question of why we should consider life in the universe to have less educational value than a Coursera MOOC on the same subject that covers less than half the material I studied through that Ohio State course. As I hope the last few minutes of commentary demonstrate, the benefit of taking all sorts of courses to completion and treating each of them with the same level of seriousness as one would a traditional college course can provide the type of experiences needed to grapple with issues, notably how much MOOCs and other forms of free learning compare to things like conventional classroom or non-massive online classes. And the completely unstartling conclusion is that MOOCs are indeed different in important ways from other forms of learning. Yes, the professors who gravitate towards teaching them are high-caliber lecturers, or in MOOC parlance, rockstar professors. But because of class size, you'll not have actual contact with those rockstars, nor will you have much interaction with fellow students unless you really dedicate yourself to wading through overcrowded discussion boards. Yes, you can learn as much from a MOOC as you can from a traditional college course, but in order to do so, you may have to put in extra work beyond what the course itself demands of you to make up for shortcomings inherent in a class taken by tens of thousands. For example, edX's Justice MOOC taught by Harvard professor Michael Sandel was pretty close to a full semester class lecture-wise. But I suspect students who have taken that course live had to do more than answer 50 relatively easy multiple-choice questions to receive a passing grade. Now, the MOOC version of that class also required students to submit answers to questions on the course discussion boards once a week. But these were ungraded, and because of the sheer number of people submitting comments on the same subject week after week, students could not expect to receive much feedback in a forum that seemed to consist primarily of students talking to themselves. But rather than dwell on these shortcomings, motivated students, including me, decided to instead treat each forum question like an essay assignment and put as much time and effort into writing responses as though they were going to be graded like short papers assigned in a traditional class. This is one example of how students can take the initiative to make up for shortcomings in massive online courses. And if you look at how MOOCs are being implemented in challenging environments, such as third-world high schools and colleges taught in courtyards and football stadiums where electricity and bandwidth are in short supply, you'll see no shortage of creativity applied to building a MOOC into a full-fledged college course experience. At the same time, the MOOC makers have not been standing still, nor were they assuming that shortcomings in the medium were permanent. For example, the component of a MOOC one would think would create the most distance between a professor and student, lectures delivered by digital video, evolved over the years in ways that were making lecturing the most intimate component of a course. Greg Nagy's Ancient Greek Hero class from HarvardX, for instance, replaced stage-on-stage lecturing with videos structured like intimate conversations between Professor Nagy, his students, and colleagues, giving you the impression that you were sitting in or eavesdropping on high-energy, informative conversations rather than being didactically lectured to. Other courses are making an effort to use lecture time to get outside the classroom, with interviews, field trips, even skits and performances, all designed to use video to do something other than shoot a man, an occasional woman, talking from behind a lectern. Professors were also experimenting with teaching techniques that had no parallel in the traditional classroom, such as crowdsourced class projects that involved the participation of thousands of people in a common effort. That Think Again course I started this conversation off with, for example, ended in an argument contest in which hundreds of students submitted arguments based on one or more principles learned in the class, which were then voted up or down by the student body, with the winners used to anchor a final lecture where the professors dissected them to see how well they illustrated one or more concepts taught during the course. Now, if you listen to a podcast interview with Kathy Davidson I did last summer, you'll hear about a crowdsourced project she's planning to include in a MOOC that comes out at the end of January that will involve thousands of students working together to create a timeline of educational history. Again, something you just can't do in a brick-and-mortar class of 30 students. Then there are those professors who refuse to accept that there are some things you could do in a classroom that you can't do in a massive learning environment. For example, in another Degree of Freedom podcast interview, Professor David Cox of Harvard described how he's going to work actual neurology experiments into his neuroscience MOOC. Bad news for invertebrates, but great news for students wanting to add real-world experimentation to a course, as also doing some interesting educational experiments in video design and course interactivity. In fact, the last course that I finished, just barely, was Science and Cooking that required students to engage in experiments in their own kitchens with grading performed via well-designed, self-scored rubrics associated with lab reports and other class submissions. Having just mentioned one of my senior year courses, Science and Cooking, it's time to get back to the Degree of Freedom story, where the second half of 2013, which corresponded to my junior and senior years, were focused on meeting major requirements. And the challenge here was that there just were not enough high-level philosophy MOOCs available to make this work. Coursera was offering courses in mathematical philosophy and Kierkegaard that fit the bill. But in order to get more high-level material into my curriculum, I had to reach out to other non-MOOC sources, like the curated courses offered by the Saylor Foundation. Studying in a curated environment involves following a course outline where each week you're assigned readings as well as lectures available from the open web. Now, while I wasn't sure if such a heterogeneous set of resources would add up to a course, it seemed to work just fine for the Saylor course in existentialist philosophy I completed over the summer. The Saylor experience inspired me to try my hand at self-curation of courses on two philosophy topics of interest, subjects not covered by any MOOCs I could find, The Metaphysics of Immanuel Kant and Pragmatic Philosophy, America's only contribution to the modern philosophical canon. And while none of these non-MOOC experiences were perfect, neither were the many MOOC experiences I've been describing. But the way one plugs the holes is always the same in any of these teaching modalities. Take the course seriously, do the work, including the reading and optional assignments, and always be looking for ways to put your learning to work. Now, those of you following the Degree of Freedom story via the blog or newsletter know that the last quarter of 2013, my senior year, was complicated by the fact that I had to complete a book manuscript on the subject of MOOCs for MIT Press during that period. And while I decided to treat this project like a senior thesis, serving as one of the 8 courses towards graduation, as November turned to December, this project required full attention, which caused me to slack off on some of my remaining courses, which I still passed, albeit without giving them my all. But this too was a learning experience, one that taught me how much a motivated student is the crucial ingredient in getting the most out of a MOOC or any other form of self-propelled learning. For when MOOCing was my primary activity, it was possible to juggle 7 or 8 courses at a time, albeit with a few sacrifices, such as time spent engaging with other students in discussion forums. But once other activities, like finishing a book, took precedent, learning was replaced by passing for the few remaining MOOCs I was wrapping up in December, which is not nearly as satisfying as an educational experience. I've been talking up until now about individual classes, which ones I took, how well they worked, their strengths, weaknesses, and the workarounds needed to get the most out of them. But the question most people asked as this project was getting close to completion was whether or not a MOOC-based BA can or should be considered the equivalent of a BA earned over 8 semesters at a traditional residential college or university. This is a question I grappled with as the Degree of Freedom project closed in on the finish line. And answers to that question, as well as reflections on what MOOCs might mean and whether they have a future, are topics I'd like to talk about a week from today, as this discussion continues on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.